Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham and we are going up to win the cup thanks to the magnificent oldfootballshirts.com. Well, it's been a week where most of us are still smiling after completing the double over the old enemy at Selhurst Park last Saturday. Tomorrow, we will try and keep that feel-good factor going as Chris Hughton bids become only the second Albion manager in our history to lead us to an FA Cup semi-final. However, Millwall and a baying den crowd might have a thing or two to say about that. Joining me today as we look back over last week and look forward to tomorrow is, of course, Alan Wares. We welcome back Marcus Hancock. We have a special late guest in the shape of, Benjamin.
For someone who's late, he's looking very well for it.
I know. Yeah. Well, you know, fresh from Berlin as well.
Hello, Piers. How are you, mate?
I'm well.
And also, a little bit later on, we'll hear from a man who knows a thing or two about scoring goals that take us to Wembley at the Den. That's Robert Codner, which is...
So we're looking forward to speak to him. Stop talking. Well. You're right.
Yeah. How's your week, guys? How's your week?
You said you had a short intro.
That was short.
No, it wasn't.
It's only one page today.
It's not like we've got nothing to talk about this
not
week.
Really, no.
So how was your week, Marcus?
Fine. I'm still
still floating.
Gloat mode. Still gloat mode at the moment.
I think everyone in Sussex is.
Has to be said, and long may it continue. That's absolutely.
I mean, there's so many aspects of that particular day to talk about. I mean, we can talk about it from various aspects. You were in the way, and we were in the press box, and all the various bits and pieces to talk about. I mean, and we've had someone flown in from Germany just for the game. And have a celebration. So many things to talk about. So
I didn't realise the rule.
But having said that, let's put it this way. Let's go back. If you go back to this time, well, this time last week was just about to prepare for kickoff. But let's face it. Let's start with this. Ahead of the game, how were you feeling?
As always, nervous.
Yeah.
As always, hating every minute of it. As always, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
As always, oh, here we go again.
Yeah.
And it is one of those places that I'm never coming back.
And then,
isn't it?
When you consider the fact that, up until, what was it, last season, we hadn't conceded three goals away at that point, and we conceded three goals in the first half last year, going back to when Lewis Dunk got sent off in the first couple of minutes in the Championship. And it's just, and then the news comes on about Andoni, and you just think, brilliant, here we go again.
Yeah.
Always against Palace. That was what I was feeling before the game.
Yeah. So you were feeling positive then?
So yeah. I'm going to do the total opposite and totally relaxed, other than the price of the pint I bought in the Rake at 10:30 in the morning.
Well, I'd have to find someone that was open at 10:30
in
the morning.
Well, we were staying in London, so it was a little bit easier. We were going the wrong way. But I think the win at home had set a few things straight with them, and I think they were starting to get nervous about playing us.
Well, give us a for instance then, about what was set straight.
Well, I think we've learned how to play them, actually. When we got to Falmer, when did we lose them? In 2011,
the playoffs.
No, Mikel Smith, where we absolutely murdered them for an hour and then proceeded to lose. And there was a sort of hold over us, and we were always slightly in awe of them. I think last season the 3-2 was just a brain fart of a game, to quote one of Marcus's phrases.
Yes.
But this year, it was worked out. They like teams to attack them, and then they pick them off. Both games, we've actually sat off them, and then allowed them not to play how they like with the pace from Zaha and
Townsend. Yeah.
Thank you. We just seem to have them under control.
It's an interesting tactic down at Farmer this season was deciding to take them on with only 10 men as well. I think as tactics go, I thought it actually worked really well.
Well, in this game, we very nearly, probably should have been taking them on with 10 men after 27 seconds as well.
But I think Piers's point is absolutely right, is that, they sit back and defend because, in Dan and Tompkins, they have players with no pace. And it's not to say that, Dunk and Duffy are ever going to break the sound barrier. Not in terms of speed.
That Tompkins got beaten for pace by Glenn Murray. Right.
He didn't. I think the other thing is, and Marcus hates this stat, they've only actually ever beaten us once in the top flight in history. We oddly, in the second tier, we're slightly their bunnies.
Well, this is in only the fourth season of playing them in the top
but
flight.
But they've beaten us once in sort of eight games now.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it's true.
We do have a little bit of a hold over them. I know
until,
it's over.
Up until last year, it wasn't any losses to Palace in the top division.
Well, I mean, yeah, to be honest, at that game at Selhurst last year, we really probably should have got something out of that game.
Right at the death. Murray forgot who he was playing for, you could almost say.
But exactly. Okay, well, let's talk about the game itself then. And as you correctly said, Andoni was named in the team only to drop out after, well, we thought it was a thigh strain at the time, but they're saying it's a groin now.
Well, it's some part of his leg that doesn't work.
So is it a Chris Hooton special? He's out for sort of 3 weeks and we'll see him in 3 months?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Okay.
Possibly. Yeah.
But he's not playing tomorrow, I believe.
But the best way to get, well, the way to get the best out of Glenn Murray is probably to upset him a little bit.
We were talking about this. I think we were certainly talking to people in the, because I want to say, me and Ada were in the press area. So you know, actually, weirdly enough, the message we got from you, Marcus, about 5-10 minutes before
kickoff. That's the first we heard of it.
That was the first we heard. That's the first. You got the scoop on the press box.
Well, there you go. Well, not me. I think it was announced on Sky, and a couple of people were watching
right,
on Sky.
Okay, fine.
Or Lewis or whatever, he said
sure.
that Murray had been.
But you could see. I think we saw Paul Cameron at half time, and he was saying, if you really want to sort of fire Glenn up, is you drop him, you upset him. And he was playing like a bear with a sore head.
No, he wasn't. He was dreadful till he scored. He had three touches, and two of them flew off his shin.
You could see him certainly in the first half from our position. It's one of the few elevated positions that you know people with their own brains are actually allowed to sit in. is you can get to see that his body language was being utterly cheesed off with the people serving the ball. He was actually gesticulating a lot, especially to knock
out. I mean, he was still controlling it as far as I could kick it for a while.
I mean, once he got the goal, then he came into the game.
He
was the dark arts of Glenn Murray, that every time Tompkins went near him, he fell over.
Yeah. Okay.
But he still looked off the pace, sorry to say, but then he scores probably the best goal he's scored all season.
No, absolutely. Yeah. But let's just rewind a little bit into the first 27 seconds into the game. Anti Knockart goes in with Milhovic, or however you pronounce it.
Was the yellow a correct decision?
No.
Well,
straight red card, feet were off the ground, letter of the law, red card. They weren't going to do it in the first minute.
So he caught the Palace captain. I mean, how are we going to phrase this? In the bread basket? Insert phrase here.
Meat and two
veg.
Golden
temple.
Golden temple.
Was working for family planning.
Yes.
So, I mean, the trouble is, it did look like a sending off. But because it happened, and without sounding like Wenger, but because it happened at the other end, because we're
and
away
your vantage point,
you know,
pathetic,
it was inside the dugout.
Yeah.
So, but you know, a few people around us were like, "Oh, that's a sending off."
Yeah.
And, you know,
I mean, they both went in with their feet up. So
that's the one thing I think in the first minute, and that. The Serbian's feet were off the ground as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, I can't pronounce his name rather than.
What's his name?
Go on, AD. Milojevic.
That's the chat. So they could almost argue, but then why wasn't he booked as well? If they both went in.
Yeah. Well, Knockart was saying that the ref spoke to him at half time and he said that if Milojevic's feet were higher as well, that he would have got the card. But I mean, it was another thing that in Knockout's favour possibly was it was a very low impact. It was happened kind of in slow motion. Okay, it wasn't like they were rushing in.
Let's put it another way. Next season he'd have been off. Because it would have gone straight to VAR, and he would have been off.
Yes. Well, this season it should have been, and like I say, there's the argument that it was always in the first minute, and that for me isn't the defence.
No.
You know, there was actually two motions to this. He went in, he leapt in a little. I don't think it was feet off the ground, but certainly the foot was high, and there was a secondary movement of the leg into his knackers. Was it spiteful? Was it deliberate? Who knows? But the point is that it was this. When you see it in slow motion, it looks a lot worse still.
Yeah.
But when you saw the two of them going in together, you think neither of them are pulling out here. Something's going to give.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was
Milojevic Holy Trinity.
But basically.
So
man's game.
He now has a Justin Edinburgh problem, doesn't he?
Short answer. Game. I think we're all agreed it should have been a red, shouldn't it?
Yeah. But I'm glad it wasn't.
I'm absolutely glad it wasn't.
I should say.
As he did it, even though the TV gantry's in the way,
it
was like, oh, we could be in trouble here.
Yes. The thing is, when you see Yves Bissouma reading, you probably can't see it, but we've got it on our little screens in the press box. When you see Yves Bissouma reading Anthony Knockart, the riot act, then you get to realise just how much trouble he should have been in.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, so, I mean, he did stay on the pitch, and we're, as Marcus says, we're mightily glad about that.
Well, quite. I've got to say this actually. I mean, I know we're going to talk about the main points, but there was a move that Palace had down the left-hand side. A knock-up was actually found 10 yards behind the pace, and the ball came in. It came to nothing, thankfully. Obviously, they didn't score, you know, from open play. But you could see somewhere down the line there was the wheels were spinning in Knockhart's head, because he was clearly not doing his job defensively. And you saw Stevens and you saw Duffy and you saw Montoya, the shrinking Violet Montoya, all screaming dog's abuse at Knockhart, get back, do your job, where were you? Wasn't concentrating in the first bit.
I mean, he might have scored a goal that we've all watched about 500 million times now, but he didn't have a good game.
He didn't have a good game apart from that one bit. Yes, he's a hero, but
the substitute was already being prepared before he scored.
But again, in his defence, he was one of the few that would try things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And they don't always come off. Yeah, that's right. I think he's blown hot and cold this season and possibly been left out unfairly at times. Yeah. But at least he tried things rather than cutting back and...
Don't go across the halfway line.
The ball gets fired into the Brighton defence. Lewis Dunn controls it. The Palace fans went up for handball. It wasn't.
They went up for handball so many times.
It kind of hit him on the shoulder a little bit.
But there was one time it hit the knee and they were screaming handball. Yeah.
I think the flares and the black hoodies got impaired their eyesight. And we'll leave it at that.
But he fires the ball forwards and the ball gets caught on the breeze, and the hapless Tompkins tries to head the ball clear and misses, and Murray is on hand to volley home for his 100th Albion League goal.
I think Tompkins did a good impression of Gary O'Reilly. It was like Phoenix from the Flames there.
that's twice Tompkins has been at fault for.
He could have thrown three heads at that and it'd have still missed it. It was genuine Sunday League defending.
Palace player and having three head shocker. Who knew?
Yeah. Do you think Lewis Dunk meant that pass?
No, he was just lumping it in the direction of Murray, not with a view.
Yeah, I think that is.
Because let's face it, if Tompkins had been in the right place, and it probably is only about 6 feet out of place, then he'd have headed it clear. Therefore, you expect Murray to be challenging for it in the usual robust elbows flying head, I'm going down type of way. But he didn't. He missed it. And then you realise that actually, let's face it, Glenn is not exactly blessed with pace. It took him a couple of seconds to realise he's missed it. I'm through here. Yeah. And like I say, when Murray beats anyone for pace, you realise this bloke is, you know, he's a proverbial oil tanker. Fact is that Tompkins should have headed it clear. So it was, I think, it was just the ball aimed in the rough postcode of Glenn Murray, but because Tompkins made a complete pig's ear of it, he was through.
It was straight out of the Charles Hughes manual.
It was the sort of goal which Glenn hasn't really scored in his second spell with us. I mean, he's scored plenty of goals on the volley from outside the box in his first spell with us. In fact, there was an anniversary of one of the goals this week.
Well, the only reason he scored such a great goal is because he didn't have the pace to take it on. Well, if he'd have taken a touch, he'd have been, you know, they'd have got back.
But I think it was also the old adage, if you hit it first time and it goes on target, the keeper's quite often not in position. You take a touch, that's the keeper to reset.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he hit it first time for once, and it went where it was meant to for once.
And he put it where he should have put the shot against Leicester a couple of weeks ago.
What, in the net?
Yes. Well, frankly, But there was a point, when you see the shot from behind the goal, just to the side of the goal, you realise just how brilliantly placed it was. I mean, he meant it, but how many of those ever go in?
Yeah, they normally go just wide. So it's well done, Glenn. I mean, we couldn't believe it when he went in. He's like, yeah. Well, it's good.
And we didn't have the fish thing on the forehead thing celebration. We had very...
Muted, well, but then he's always said he would never celebrate scoring.
It was a bit of a Dennis Law shake the hand, wasn't it?
It was. Yes. He just sort of like snotted his nose a bit, and then Nocky just come and jumped on him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we'll talk about his non-celebration after Knockout's goal in a minute. But I mean, okay, let's move on. There was another talking point where we had a free kick on the edge of the box, and Shahan Bash put it into the danger zone, and Shane Duffy gets wrestled to the floor, it should have been a penalty all day long.
Could you see that from your end?
To be honest, I was more that their defence had flapped at the cross, and why the hell wasn't Dunk or Duffy on the far post putting it in?
Yeah.
If you watch it in real time, and then of course the text start coming through from those on TV who are the experts, saying it should have been a penalty. But we in that melee, you had no chance. And how often are they given?
I agree with Piers on that one, and I think also again because it was at the other end of the ground, we. you saw a Brighton player take a tumble, but you couldn't quite see what was going on. You know, you didn't see all the elbows. Or
to be honest, even in our elevated position, we couldn't see. We saw him go down.
But Piers, I mean, you're currently living in Germany at the moment. Are you going to watch games in Germany at the moment?
I try not to because the standard's awful.
Right, but I mean, when you do, because obviously they've got VAR over there at the moment anyway in that league, and they're dead set against it.
I went to Hertha Schalke the other week, and the problem is that they refer to it and you don't know what's going on. And not because it's in German, but it's still not communicated properly. So there's this sort of break-in game. Now, in fairness, it was -9 at that game and all I wanted to do was go home because I wasn't interested. But VAR will be a bit like the DRS in cricket. It will be dreadful for the first couple of years. They'll tweak it and it will settle down. Mm. Players will learn how to use it. This is the other thing. I know it's not the referral system, but the officials and everything will get their head around it. But next year is going to be an absolute cluster something.
We had it for the Derby game, the FA Cup game here, and there was one time, I think it was the school were trying to do their best to keep people informed. Now, we've had it VAR at the Amex, three or four times?
We had the first ever game in the UK to have it.
But my point is that, that's by the by, my point is that we haven't had major contentious issues to do with it. And people say, why isn't that referred to VAR? Well, everything is referred to VAR. It's a case of whether the referee has been suggested to look at it. And the only one that happened, to my mind, was when they, against Derby, and the message on the scoreboard came up, VAR checking for red card incident. In other words, I saw something off the ball, and I think it was just a bit of a coming together rather than a deliberate clatter. But the point is, what doesn't help is that not every Premier League club has a scoreboard, which doesn't help. So it's
all that Bournemouth money. Anyway, yes, moving on.
Well, it's Old Trafford specifically doesn't have that scoreboard. So no, so it's,
Anfield doesn't either.
No,
not because someone. No, no.
Yeah, yeah. But so yes, it's. I think it's this case of if people are kept informed. But the whole ridiculous notion of it being 2.5 minutes of
then
mucking
Aaron,
around.
Do we? I think there's two choices here. Is it like rugby as it is at the moment, or do they actually go down more of a cricket route that the coach has two referrals in the game? That
I think
they can
I would
use?
Prefer that.
I don't. And I don't think the players should have any rights.
Well,
no,
I'm saying the coaches, because the captain on the football pitch is irrelevant.
Well, Ruud Gullit came up with an idea this week about having a referral system, and basically in. The fact that if you get it wrong, you lose a substitution.
Yeah. Well, not the substitution.
Now it gets silly, isn't it?
I think it has to be like rugby. But then what's the point of the on-field referee at that point? Yeah. Because if you watch rugby now, everything just goes to the ball.
I mean, that's the kind of thing they have in tennis, isn't it? Where they have so many.
Yeah, but it's instant though, isn't it? I mean, the Hawkeye they use in tennis is 10 seconds top whack. Mm. When you're talking about 2.5 minutes, I mean, for instance, the goal line. We've said this on the show before. The goal line technology is 3 seconds or something like that. Yeah. It's instant. Bang, it's done. Nothing's going to happen those next 2 seconds or whatever it is. But when you've have to stop the game, you can't. And if you start the game again, then VAR goes out the window, and so on and so forth.
But I am looking forward next season to Southern being able to use VAR as an excuse for the trains not being there.
Okay, let's just move it on then. Palace started to ask some questions after that, but we had all the answers. And then
good cliche.
I know.
Did they? They just moved the ball sideways.
Just before half time, I just feel that before we move on, I just want to talk about Tompkins' very embarrassing attempt to get a penalty just before the whistle, half time whistle.
Good. And that was down your end. He just kind of threw himself upwards and downwards was it into Dunk or was it into Stevens?
I think the more important one there was they actually missed a very good chance that they put the wrong side of the post. The penalty had a bit of the sort of Andy Kennedy Swan Lake to it.
We gave Dale Stevens man of the match afterwards, and his performance was one where people could actually see what he does.
The thing is,
again,
we're talking about perspectives. We're from an elevated view. We've got the TV screens, but you know, down in the sort of basically the letterbox dungeon that you're in at the Arthur Waite stand.
Stevens, it was Stevens, and Steve comes back to.
Yeah,
Brighton. I think this isn't just a Brighton fan thing. Football fans. The stock of a player goes up when they don't play.
Yes.
And Stevens does a dirty job, that water carrier type job. He's not glamorous, and so people sort of don't understand what he does until you get a backs to the wall type game.
Yes.
And you see him mopping everything up, protecting that back four. And he was brilliant. He has been off the pace recently. I don't deny that. But I think he does a job that a lot of... emotive fans don't understand always.
He's probably best when we don't have the ball, because the other team can't do a great deal with it. Example being Palace last week, who, as you just said, went sideways a lot.
And it means they can't play through the middle. When it works, they have to go out wide. Now, obviously, then you put two players on Zaha, and it kills that tactic.
Yes.
But this thing with us playing three central midfielders at the moment, it does like leave us without any real width. And you,
but
and
we're not. We've almost gone back to last season's formation now.
Yeah.
It's a bit more fluid, but it's not 4-3-3 anymore.
No.
We've stopped leaking through the middle.
To try and give a sort of specific number or some traditional, I mean, you get back to again someone you mentioned, the Charles Hughes thing of, right, it's 4-4-2, it's 4-5-1, it's 4-3-3. It's those numbers are almost irrelevant. It's basically the fact that you've got those three, as you say, central midfielders, but they themselves take it in turns. Bissouma sometimes is the forward one of the three. Then at times you see Bissouma drop back and Purple goes forward. There is that fluidity and about it. I think it has to be.
I think to play Bissouma, you have to play three. He's not disciplined enough at the moment to play in a two-man midfield, whereas Stevens and Proper last year were very good at just holding that line.
They were the brick wall. You know, so many teams didn't... Well, they didn't know what to make of us, for one, but in kind of underestimating, and we're back to, for instance, the Arsenal game at the end of last season, where nothing got past them, and that was probably their tour de force. If you want to, if ever they want to be judged as Premier League players, then look at that game, because they were superb that day.
Okay, well... Palace did get themselves on the score sheet, and it was another penalty for them. It's that they only ever seem to score penalties.
Well, that's what I was saying. They've only scored penalties against us this season.
It was Townsend brought down in the box.
Yeah, but it was Duffy giving the ball away in the face beforehand that caused the problem. And Proper then gets to a point where he probably should have just tried to shield him out.
Yeah,
but.
He felt the ball was there.
I mean,
there is
an argument that Townsend was already going over.
No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't, not at all. I mean, that thing of him leaning slightly, you lean that way because you're about to take the next step. The basic physics of actually walking or running is that you're permanently off balance, and that's what, you know.
And why shouldn't he look to go over? In the modern game, we'd expect our players to do the same. I know it's annoying when it goes against you, but
the point
it
is,
will even Kruper up.
Kruper still caught him. You know, he still knocked him over.
Well, Milivojevic,
he does take a good penalty, actually.
Does it become a cult that he takes, like Letizia, that it becomes a cult he takes a good penalty so no one thinks they can save it as well?
He has missed a few. I have seen him miss a few.
Ryan's got nowhere near the two he is against him, so.
Okay. We were just talking about Dale Stevens there. Let's just give him a little bit more praise for that ball we actually played out to Knockhart.
Brilliant. Absolutely wonderful.
The game had been stretched a little bit because in the first half, I mean, Knockhart didn't actually have an awful lot of space. And in that one particular, I mean, Palace, I think, were looking to get the winner and were suckered into it and actually were leaving spaces at the back. In the first half, Knockhart wouldn't have been. That space.
No.
But it also comes back to who's willing to try something. You do wonder if March or...
March would have cut back.
Or
no
the,
question.
Or Ali Jahanagovic. We've got a friend. We're not allowed to call... Oh, no, what's that group? You're not allowed to call him the Iranian or anything. There's been a whole... The Persian wonder.
Persian prince.
Yes. These guys, you just wonder, would they have done that? And if Knockhart's lost the ball, he's hit the fullback, hasn't worked, everyone's effing and blinding. But sometimes that's what wins you a game. And this is a total cliche I've just come out with, so apologies.
No, it's brilliant. But Izquierdo tries it, and he ends up hoofing it into the touchline.
But then every so often he does what he did against West Ham, where he just goes
flying
in the top.
He only does it against West Ham. But yeah, no, the thing is, March has done it. He just, for me, Solly March doesn't do it enough. I mean, he scored a worldie for England under 21s. He scored that worldie in a friendly. And I'd like to see him try that again. He can do
it.
Glenn
has said that on the record. He said, you know, Solly March does stuff in training that you think is frightening. He's a good trainer.
Yes.
But as he did, Glenn did say in the Argus,
maybe
he wants to see him do it, you know, in the first team.
Maybe we should speak to his agent about it.
In a minute.
I think also, I mean, I'm a critic of March. I don't mind admitting that. To me, he's probably the most talented player on the books.
Yes.
And it's sometimes taking that talent and applying it. And it's this almost fear of physical failure.
But do you think that is down, again, and this is something that, you know, and again, I don't want to bang on too much about it, but do you think sometimes it is because when he crosses the line, it might be something, sort of a mental block, maybe?
Well,
or do you think it might be down to the coaching in the sense of,
We're going to talk about this in a minute because I did speak to Robert Codner about this week. Who is his agent? We're going to speak to him in a minute.
But the point is you got Knockout does try it. Yeah. Ali Reza does try it. Yeah. Izquierdo does try it. And for me, March can put in a decent. They can all put in a decent cross. They can all put in appalling crosses. Yeah. But for me, he doesn't actually get the chance to shoot enough. And if he does, then it's just a kind of this little powder puff carpet creeper thing. But he can do it. The point is, you know, he can do it.
On his day, he's unplayable.
Yeah, I think that's the point. And I suspect if you ask them in that squad, he's the real talent that could go all the way. Mm. And it's then whether he can kick on.
Okay.
But you did mention, actually, we do have to talk about this, is that when Knockout did put that ball, and I love the way that Sidwell described it, right where the spiders live.
Wow.
Yeah. Was Glenn's reaction.
Oh, yeah.
Where normally, if he didn't get the ball played into him, he'd be screaming dog's abuse. But it was kind of this OMG look.
It was such a great finish, and yeah. If that was against anyone else, he would be like going absolutely mental, rest of the players. He was just trying not to laugh.
I think that's what it was. He's trying not to laugh.
Was it a little bit of Stuart Broad at Trent Bridge?
I was just about to mention Stuart Broad when who was it? It was Ben Stokes, wasn't it? Catches the ball in the slips, so that's about 5 yards behind him. He does the hand over the mouth thing. OMG. Knockout goes loopy. I love the way that, and then there's a great picture from Simon Dack that just about everyone has shared. It looks like Stevens is parachuting in. I love that picture. And there's the kind of like the dead body on the ground shadow kind of thing.
To be honest, the best photo on Saturday is Zahar just lying on the floor.
Yeah, that was
planking.
There was another absolutely brilliant photo, not of that goal, but of Glenn's goal of the ball in midair just going past the keeper, which is in the Guardian.
No, but it's the pure joy of on knock his face. And also, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about the rest of the game, it's also all the pictures of, you know, on final whistle, the way that Lewis, because obviously you lot are going mental, but we've got a kind of a broader overview. We saw Lewis Dunk, forget shaking everyone's hand, goes bounding over to the Brighton fans like a springbok, like a spring lamb, bang, 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 bang. And bearing in mind the dog's abuse they've been giving him over the outrageous stuff from a few years ago. You know, I mean, he's actually sort of sticking it to them. And even as he's walked off, you can see him sort of, he's not flipping the bird, but he's kind of given the eye saying, yeah, done you again kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's Duffy's trying to usher them off the pitch to get an early bus back. But anyway.
Exactly. Come on, lads, we've got West Street and Jager Bombs.
we can hit happy hour in Revolution.
So how did you celebrate? Apart from going, I mean, obviously limbs within the state. It was all total limbs in the stadium. But what about afterwards?
Bermondsey Beer Mile, obviously, because, you know, la-di-da hipsters.
Yes.
the least unhipster-like people went on that pub crawl.
I can imagine.
Couldn't possibly come. Well, I mean, we're absolutely delighted. First double since 1984.
Yeah, but Palace haven't done the double over us since 1933. Yeah. Not that we care about that. They weren't even rivals in those days.
Aren't we now too clear of them as well on the win total?
Is it four now?
Let's just cling to everything possible. Because they would do the same to us.
Absolutely. Well, they don't even want us as rivals anymore.
That's because they keep losing.
Yeah, it's funny that.
Okay. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Aidy Packham here with Alan Wares, Marcus Hancock, and Piers Benjamin. We're shortly going to be joined by Robert Codner as well. But we are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and I'm just going to pass this thing over to Marcus there. And can you just describe this one for us, chaps?
Red and grey.
Red Bull on acid.
Yes, it's a red shirt with, what would you call those? Not chevron, are they?
They're kind of chevrons.
Sort of shoulder.
Sort of go slow stripes grey, almost.
Go slow stripes. It's kind of, you know, those Coventry kits in the sort of 70s. The sort of that sort of thing with the, so it's a red shirt with grey.
I think it's kind of more grey beigey Coventry brown bits. Grey.
Yeah.
Really.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Oh, you have to give the printer a little bit of...
Bossini are the sponsors.
It's the sort of kit that actually would probably sell millions because it's so hideous.
Yeah. That's like the England Grey, isn't it? Almost like that of the 96.
Do you want to have a hazard a guess about who it is?
No.
Torino.
Actually, you're right country. It is the right country.
Okay, then... red. Bari.
Udinese.
No, it's not. This is what Phil Shelley from oldfootballshirts.com has to say about this particular minger. Here is your shirt of the week, and it's this time it's rotten, says Phil. This is the 1998-99 shirt of Italian Serie B side, US Cremonese, and they are sponsored by local firm Bossini, and they are manufacturers of agricultural trailers, muck spreaders, dumpsters, and cesspit emptying machines.
So they've got the contract at Sellers Park.
Basically, yeah. But they go by two nicknames, the imaginative Grigio Rossi, which is grey and reds, and Le Tigre, which is the Tigers. The home ground is the Stadio Giovanni Zini, which is named after a former goalkeeper who died in the First World War of typhoid. The stadium holds 20,641 Tironi munching Cremonese. When for well, thanks for that. The side has played for most of its history outside of Serie A, but has had a handful of seasons in the top flight. And in the 92-93 season, they won the Anglo-Italian Cup, beating Derby County 3-1 at Wembley Stadium in the final. Marco Gabellini scored Derby's consolation goal in that game. Some other links to the UK: one, Luca Vialli began his career with the Grey and Reds, making over 100 appearances, and Anders Limpar played for a season, scoring 3 times before moving to Arsenal. John Aloisi became the first Australian to score in La Liga, the Premier League and Serie A with Cremonese, Coventry City and Osasuna. So thanks for that, Phil, and that is absolutely minging. And you can go and have a look at all of those shirts and many, many more at oldfootballshirts.com. Now, we are now...
You're excited by this next bit, aren't you?
I am a bit, actually. It's, how many players have scored a goal that got us to Wembley?
Or from the halfway line at Home Park. Let's go with the important one.
That one's been mentioned a few times. But we now welcome him. He played 315 times for the Albion between 1988 and 1995. He scored 47 times, including a goal at the Den in the 1991 playoff semi-final. He's now an agent, and amongst his charges is a young lad from Eastbourne called Solly. Ladies and gents, it's only Robert Codner. Hello, Robert.
Hello, how are you?
We're very well. Thanks for joining us here on the Albion Roar. Now, you've been a busy lad, and obviously we're going to talk about Solly a little bit later on, but we're going to the FA Cup quarterfinal tomorrow at the Den. And, you know, you scored that magnificent goal. When you scored that goal, you looked shocked. Your hands went to your forehead like you couldn't quite believe it.
It was excitement, shock. And obviously, I think I got the fourth goal in the first leg. And it was one of surprise and again, one of shock. But enjoyable.
I think what a lot of people don't necessarily realise, and it's a great quiz question, Robert, is that you are actually Albion's all-time leading goal scorer in playoff matches.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's a new one for me.
There you go.
I'll take that.
You're with a massive total of two.
Two.
Well, listen, I'm still the top goal scorer.
That's absolutely a record is a record. There's
no
problem with that.
But no, I didn't know that.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Let's take it back to the beginning, Robert. How come you started and joined the Albion in the first place?
Sorry, say that again.
Go, AD.
Well, it was in a sliding doors moment. You very nearly ended up at Millwall until Barry Lloyd came in with a late bid for you when you came to the Albion from Barnet.
That's right. I think I played for Millwall against Brighton, and I think obviously I did quite well. I think Barry was watching that game, and then obviously after that there was a deal done, but obviously Barry topped that, and hence I ended up coming to Brighton instead.
Because, I mean, when Barry was there when he saw you, he was actually watching another player, which is Nicky Bissett, who also signed that same week.
That's right, yeah, we both signed. And as he said, he was watching Nicky Bissett, and obviously I caught his eye as well, and the rest is history. God Barry was there then.
Now, when you joined the Albion, you famously kept your job in the city. How long did you keep that up for?
I kept out for must have been about 6 months, maybe. But obviously, I kept being late. So, which everybody kind of knew me for in the beginning. But then, obviously, I gave that up and then concentrated on the football.
Yeah, but you, I mean, your, with your career, I mean, you had a few trials and stuff. You were at Leicester for a while, Barnet and a few other non-league sides before you came to the Albion. But you actually made your league debut. It was the 10th of September 1988. Can you remember the game?
I think, if I'm correct, it was Bournemouth at home.
Yeah, we did. Can you remember the team?
Okay. I don't, to be fair. It's a long time ago.
It was a game. We lost 2-1. Gary Chivers scored the goal for us. The team that day was...
That's right.
It was John Keely, Gary Chivers, Keith Dublin, Alan Kerbishley, Bob Isaac, who's a player I completely forget ever played for the Albion.
Charlie.
I can't remember. I must have seen him play most of his games, but I cannot remember him at all.
Andy, I just hope Robert Isaac isn't listening now.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't think he played that many games, to be fair.
I don't think he did. But also we had Steve Gatting, Gary Nelson, Adrian Owers, Jerry Armstrong, Dean Wilkins, some bloke called Robert Codner. And I would have been really upset about you playing in that game, because the player you replaced was my all-time favourite Albion player, Steve Penny.
Oh, did I? That's right. I think I got a lot of stick for that, actually, for replacing Steve Penny, because he's a crowd favourite. But I think in the end, hopefully, I justified that. So
no, absolutely. You know. Absolutely. Listen, Robert, let's take it on to probably sort of the most successful season of your time here. So that we're talking about the 1991 season. We got to the playoffs and what have you. But I mean, you know, the bizarre stat from the year is we finished the season with a minus goal difference. But tell us about the team and the whole sort of atmosphere and the squad and everything, you know, during that season. Tell us how it panned out for you personally.
I think it was that season, it was a gradual thing with the team. Obviously, Barry had brought a lot of unknown players, you know, into the team, and it took a little bit of time for us to gel. I think we were quite a long way off coming into the running. I think nobody gave us a sort of like a chance to really reach the playoffs, but obviously the group that we had, we realised that we had a great opportunity to get in there, and we did go on a really, really good run, which culminated in us getting into the playoffs. And I don't think anyone gave us a chance really of beating the big boys at that time, which was Millwall. Yeah. And you know, but we thought we could beat them, and you know. Obviously, the way the game started off, everyone most of all thought, right, we're going to lose by maybe two or three.
Yeah. But just before well that, though, what can you remember about that last game of the season at the Goldstone against Ipswich that got us into the playoffs?
Yeah, if I remember rightly, I think it was Dean Wilkins.
Yeah,
it
was, Still talks about
he scored a free kick. Was it a free kick?
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether it was a free kick. But Dean scored a last-minute free kick, which was unbelievable.
It was.
But obviously, Dean was a free kick specialist, and you know, took most of our free kicks, set up a lot of my goals. To be fair to him, you know, but it was an amazing feeling when it went in, you know, because obviously we realised then we were you know going to go into the playoffs.
I think
you
know, Wilkins' free kick was helped by the fact it was Phil Parks in goal, and I'm a slightly tubby chap, but that fella I don't think in recorded history has ever got off the ground. So
well, all I will say to that is I'm just pleased that Dean Wilkins took that free kick. That's
absolutely
all I can say.
I mean, was there any argument at the time as to who was going to take it, or was it more the argument as to what he was going to do with it? Either cross it or shoot.
It was more what he was going to decide what he was going to do with it, and thank God he made the right decision.
Absolutely.
Because we went into that game, we were 2 points behind Middlesbrough in seventh position, and that free kick, it was pretty much the last kick of the game, and in injury time, the other game had already finished. They were already celebrating when that goal went in. So it was just one of those absolutely magnificent moments for an Albion fan.
That kind of thing, what does that mean for you? I mean, obviously, we're going loopy, we're in the playoffs and what have you, but I mean, I guess probably once the final whistle went, you realised that actually, hey, great, we've made it. I mean, do you remember sort of those celebrations afterwards, or did you think, no, we haven't got there yet, we've still got a job to do?
No, we obviously, there was a celebration afterwards, but it wasn't a fact of we thought, you know, well, we're through or anything like that. Obviously, we knew we had a job to do. Playing Millwall, and we knew going into the game that we were going to be underdogs, and you know that we would all have to turn up on the day to beat that Millwall team.
Yes, and thank God we did. So basically, the celebrations weren't down West Street with Jaeger bombs,
because they didn't exist back then.
I think I had a few of them.
But the point is that, I mean, you know, look at the result in the first leg. It was 4-1. I mean, it, you know, as much as you were confident, there's no way you thought you right. Okay, lads, we're going to stick four past them. I mean, you can't go into a game like that thinking that that's going to happen, can you?
No, I mean, listen, after the first sort of like 10, 15 minutes of the game, you thought, you know, there was only going to be one team in it, because they did start really well. They started really fast.
Absolutely.
And, you know, they got the early breakthrough as well. Mm. So
yeah, and we did go
it was
into
kind of a test of character for the team, for the players. And I thought we came through that really, really well. Yeah. We didn't sort of like panic. We kept to our guns and, you know, we ended up... you know, getting a result that we needed.
We were really underdogs going into that game, weren't we?
Yes, very big underdogs. I mean, they had some big players, you know. Mm.
Well, Sherring was playing that day.
And Mascherino.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. So what do you remember about your goal that day?
What do I remember about the guy? I remember breaking from midfield. I think Gary Chivers had the ball on the right-hand side.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he played the ball into... to Mike Small.
Yeah.
And if I remember rightly, I made a kind of like a third man run off of anticipating that Mike was going to see me and slip me through, which he did.
Yeah.
So thank you to the big man.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went through, kept my nerve, kept my composure, and slotted it in. And
it
as I said, I was ecstatic, couldn't believe it, because obviously it's great feeling scoring in such an important game.
Yeah.
And,
It was such a lung-busting run from you as well. It was brilliant. I was watching this goal this morning. It's actually, for those who haven't actually seen it, the highlights of both the first and the second leg, actually, they've just put them on Seagulls TV this morning, actually.
But
they're on YouTube as well. And it's, you know, it was just absolutely, it's just joyous. Now, so we're 4-1 up, going to the Den. The Den, it's not quite the same, the new Den as the old Den. It was quite a horrible place to go back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very intimidating. Going to the old Den because you had to go through like a sort of like a cage before you went onto the pitch. It was like a little cage thing that you had to walk through. It was open, and obviously supporters were like, you know, like giving you a load of abuse as you walked out.
Mm. So I mean,
so it was quite an intimidating place. You was quite close to the fans as well on the pitch. It was quite an intimidating ground. So
sure, but what do you remember about the game itself, the second leg game itself? What do you remember of it?
I just remember that we thought, you know, they're going to come at us straight away. Barry's just said to us, you know, we've just got to, you know, make sure no goals go in for the first 20 minutes. And obviously, you know, we tried to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously I think I'm not sure who scored first. I don't know whether it
they
was
did.
Me
they
you scored the first.
I think
you
they
scored,
got the goal.
They got the first
I think
goal.
They,
yeah, John McGinley.
Did we get the first goal? I'm not sure.
No, John McGinley scored for Millwall first, and it was yours that was the equaliser. So again, let's you know.
That's right.
That's
yeah. So obviously when they went 1-0 up, it was they must have thought right, you know, they were going to come back into it.
Mm.
And then obviously when I scored the equaliser, the whole ground just went silent. Obviously, we were ecstatic, but again, it was kind of like the Alamo after that. But John Robertson,
yes,
came on, I think, and
his first
scored
goal for us.
A really good second goal.
It was, and they weren't very happy. My memories of that game were, I mean, it was like you said, it was a hostile place to go. But the Millwall fans knocked off a policeman's helmet, stuffed it with newspaper, and set it on fire. That's how happy they were about it. But
okay, they tried to come on the pitch at the end as well, so
yes,
you know, to try and get to some of the players, they had to stop the game, and that because they tried to get hold of Mark Beeney. Must have grabbed one of their players.
Beeney ran the Millwall.
But I mean, if you exclude last season's game in the league against Spurs, that was still the last Albion team ever to get to a Wembley final. I mean, obviously we got to a playoff final in Cardiff, but that was the last Albion team to ever actually qualify to get to Wembley. So, and obviously tomorrow we get the chance to do that again. Although there is the argument about whether the semi-final should be there or not. But when you got to Wembley, when you saw that kit we wore in the playoff final for the first time, what was your reaction?
I thought, oh my God. I've got to say, it's most probably one of the worst kits Brighton have ever produced. But listen, it was, we stood out, that's for sure.
Did you stand out to each other, though?
No, I didn't. I didn't think it was the best choice of kit.
No. Listen, it's still legendary now. 30 years later, nearly, it's legendary now. So
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is.
as something completely minging. But but the Wembley day itself, it just didn't happen, really, did it?
No, I think it might have been a game too far for us as a team. I don't know. We just really didn't play with the same intensity that we did in the Millwall game, the two Millwall games. Mm-hmm. And it was maybe, as I say, a game too far for us. And, you know, we ended up losing that game, which was very, very disappointing.
Sure.
You know, because no one likes to lose at Wembley.
Of course.
Okay, well, I mean, it's the FA Cup tomorrow. Also that season, mm-hmm. there was a famous FA Cup game as well where we had to go to Anfield. And John Crumplin still got John Barnes in his pocket, I believe, after that game.
Yeah, I think yes, I remember speaking to John about that as well. So yeah,
but okay. Well, you've what did playing for Brighton actually mean to you?
Sorry,
what did playing for Brighton actually mean to you?
Well, obviously, when you play football, obviously you love playing football. But it's when you're like now, and you look back at it, I mean, it meant a hell of a lot to me, and it still does today. You know, I go to most home games. Mm. You know, and Brighton, it means of most of my football career was at Brighton.
Yeah, 315 games. That's not many people have played that many games for us.
Yeah, and obviously sometimes you don't realise it at that time, but even up to the other day when I'd done a Q&A at the Wolves game and didn't realise I was one of the first black captain.
Yeah,
Captain Brighton. Oh, really? I mean, I didn't even know that at the time.
I think you still are. We were talking about this yesterday. I'm not sure if Michelle ever captained us, but I think you still are.
Yeah.
Unless Jeff Minton did.
That's possible. Yeah.
I think Jeff might have done, actually.
Okay.
He might have been the other one.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it in those terms. The thing is, I don't think of it in
those
terms.
Moments are proud moments, you know?
Sure.
Those moments are proud moments.
Absolutely.
Okay, as I say.
But you've gone on. You've got a very, very different career now, and you're an agent. How did that come about?
Like all footballers of that generation, you wonder what you're going to do. You either go and get a pub, or you you know, you go into racing dogs or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just took that path.
And, sure. Did it help that you had a city background?
Yes and no. Yes and no. But really it's more about having the contacts and being able to spot talent and try and mentor it and nurture it, you know.
Okay, so how many clients do you actually have?
That's very rude.
I have about 10 now.
Okay,
and one of those is a young lad from Eastbourne called Solly.
That's Solly March.
Now, obviously, playing, he's a local lad, he's from there, but he very nearly ended up at Newcastle.
Yes, he did. We went up to Newcastle. He got taken ill on the day of the trial, and then we came back from being up there, and they wanted him to come back up, but then obviously Solly decided that he might want to be closer to home. Mm-hmm. And then that's how he went into Brighton, and the rest is, you know, history.
Because he was at Lewis at the time, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Yeah, he was just playing for Lewis's. I think he was just breaking into Lewis's first team.
Sure, that's quite a leap from Lewis to Newcastle. But I mean, without sort of like breaking too many confidences here, we were talking about Solly's qualities on the pitch, and for us on a certain level, we can see what he can do, and we know that he's actually brilliant in training, and you can't help feeling there's so much more to come from him. But as a person, tell us about Solly. You know, the Solly that you know.
Solly's very quiet. He's a really well-mannered young man. He's a pleasure to work with. He's a great human being. Mm-hmm. You know. He's a sort of person, you know, if you had a daughter, you'd be definitely keeping your daughter because he doesn't give any problems. But yeah. No, he's just a genuine all-round nice guy and a pleasure to work with.
Too nice for a football pitch?
Sorry?
Too nice for the football pitch?
We know that he's not.
No, I don't think he's too nice for the football pitch. Right. I mean, he has got devilment in him. I just think sometimes... he's got a role to play within the team, yeah. And I think he does that role pretty well. Sometimes it takes away some parts of his game, but yeah. Listen, when you're asked to do something, you've got to do that, and you've got to follow instructions. Yeah, because, and that's what he's
a player that does get a fair amount of stick. It would be fair to say, but probably because we know and we've all seen him on his day, he's absolutely unplayable, and I think we'd just like to see a little bit more of that from him.
Yeah, and I think you know, if Solly was honest with himself, I think he wants to do that more himself.
He's given
but go on.
Yeah, do you think under Chris he's actually given a lot more defensive responsibility, so he has to restrict himself a little bit?
Yeah, I think I think Chris has done an amazing job with Brighton and still doing an amazing job. Mm-hmm. Long may it continue. I just think with Solly's he's an attacking player, but obviously, you know, he has to do a lot of defensive stuff in the formation that he's played in. But obviously, he needs to now start looking at expressing himself a little bit more, I suppose, and showing people the attacking side of his game.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there, Robert. We'll have to. You have to come in and see us here in the studio one day, and we'll chat some more. But many thanks for that.
Yeah, no problem. No problem.
You're looking forward to tomorrow?
Yes, I am, and I'm hoping to be there. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And if we turn up and we match them for their work ethic, I think there should only be one winner, and that should hopefully be Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club.
Well, we've got to leave it there. Absolutely. That's brilliant. Many thanks.
Thanks, Robert.
That's Robert Codner, former Albion midfielder, and what a nice guy.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, he clearly talks. He loves his game. He was at the club at a funny time. You know, there was a kind of relative unpopularity with the management at the time. You know, there was, and it was a kind of a. You know, we can't help feeling we got to the playoffs in 91, kind of despite ourselves rather than because ourselves. I mean, what do you remember of that particular playoff season?
It's one of my most favourite seasons following the Albion, I think.
Yeah.
Because it all sort of ultimately ended in disappointment, like life, I guess. So.
Oh, dear. Thanks for coming in, Marcus.
I mean, but no, we had, you know, we played Liverpool home and away in that season, yep. As well, in a cup, like you say, and, yep. You know, a trip to Wembley, and it was, you know, silly... Chewett wrapper kits, you know, making its debut.
He was a pull. I mean, Robert just said he was a pull by that kit.
And a great, you know, and a really nice home shirt, actually. I really did like the home shirt.
The Sports Express. That was Tesco's bag one, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but I like that one.
The Sports Express.
Yeah, the Santec shirt, which is probably the favourite one
he
ever.
He was probably the Solly March of his time as well, when you think about it, because he had all the talent in that squad. And he could just go missing. I mean,
yeah, I think he's probably one of the highest goal scorers in a season for midfield. I think he got 10 that season. He used to
average about 8 a season. I mean, he scored 47 goals for us, so that's nothing to stick.
And that's mostly in the second tier, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay, but I mean, we go to the Den tomorrow. It's a FA Cup game, quarterfinal, second one in a row. Chris Hughton has the opportunity to be only the second Albion manager to lead us to an FA Cup semi-final, and that's massive.
And it's when you think of who the first one was, and I was never a big fan of Jimmy Mealy. All right, he did brilliantly for us, but he also took us down.
Yeah, I don't know.
But do you think that Chris has got a pair of white shoes ready just in case?
No, not as such. No,
he probably doesn't even have one eye on the semi-final just tomorrow.
No, absolutely. I mean, listen, I've said this many times. I mean, and you can look at the stats, and I think the stats will back it up. But it's the unquantifiable. For me, Chris Hughton is my favourite ever Brighton manager. I think he's the best one. Don't get me wrong; it's in a fierce competition with Alan Mullery. But there is something kind of, you know, there's something a leap that you can't actually quantify. That, you know, this is a perfect fit. All right, we've had a little bit of a ropey sort of, you know, couple of months, 6 weeks, whatever it might be, and people are judging him on that, which is absolutely ridiculous. This is a fellow who's taken us from, you know, where we were. He's realised our potential and is continuing to do so. Yeah, all right, even if we muck it up against Millwall, I still love the guy. So the whole thing of, yeah, he's only the second manager to do it. Sorry, it's only this, you know, it's not only down to the manager, it's down to the players to do it. We have a brilliant chance of getting to the semi-final, but, you know, who knows?
If they could do it in normal time, that would be helpful, yeah. Because I don't want to be getting twitchy on getting my flight tomorrow night.
There's a message for the team.
But Marcus Millwall, I mean, their form isn't great. Obviously, they won midweek, which will give them a little bit of breathing space in the league. But, I mean, it's the FA Cup, so the form book goes out the window.
Yeah, let's get the cliches out.
Thank you, Mr. Partridge.
They don't call me cliche for nothing.
It's 11 v 11. Yeah. It's played on grass.
It's anyone's game on the day.
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. Yeah. Sick as a parrot, over the moon.
Yeah. You walked into that, didn't you, really?
We get 3 points for a cup game, exactly. Ashley Barnes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same for both sides.
But Marcus, I mean, how do you see it going tonight?
I think we will probably squeeze through, but it's not going to be easy.
No, I mean, look at the number they did on Everton.
Exactly. I think, you know, it's going to be...
You've got a wall against complacency, haven't we?
Yeah, there's another one there. Okay.
The pitch will be the great leveller.
How many of this are also postmen and bankers and...
Crowd will be 12th man.
Dockers. I think it will be the old thing of whether the first 20 minutes that will be a full stadium, they can get on top of you. We are clicheing it, but the way that stadium is designed, and it's, let's get the last cliche in, silence the crowd with an early goal.
Yes. Happy now?
How many points do I win on the bingo for that?
You smashed it, Piers. You smashed it.
Next time I'll do it in German.
God, please don't. The point is,
heard Adi's French and Spanish.
Have you heard his English? Okay, mate. Right. Okay. I think we're done up for the week, aren't we now?
I think that is pretty much.
Can we just finish it on the best press release ever by the Palace Ultras yesterday? Moaning about the team hugging Brighton players in the tunnel, and the Palace fans are the club, and the players were a disgrace, and they should be stepping up today, and they're currently losing. It was brilliant.
It was good.
Sorry, look, find it on Twitter. Anyone that's listening,
but that is all we do actually have time for this week. So we're all excited about going tomorrow. Hopefully, we'll be talking about next week going to Wembley, maybe. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. It's going to be a tough game tomorrow. But thank you to Marcus Hancock. Thank you to Piers Brendan. Thank you to Alan Wears. Thank you to Robert Codner. I've been Adi Packham, and we will see you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye. It might seem crazy.